Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz and joined by Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, I'm curious if you got your tickets already for the World Cup, the FIFA World Cup in Qatar.
You know, I'll be saving my money for a different trip.
A different trip. Because if you didn't know, Lahav, if you log in to the FIFA website, right, FIFA being the organizer of the Federation of International Football Association, right, which arranges this World Cup gathering of the best teams and players around the world, and is taking place in the Middle Eastern Gulf state of Qatar. You can't say that you're coming from Israel, right? It's you would have to click on or select from the drop-down menu the Palestinian territory occupied. Right. Apparently, Israelis don't exist.
And what's weird is that this comes after Qatar agreed to allow Israelis into the country on their own passports.
They had no choice, right? They, in order to host one of these international gatherings, you have to allow everyone from all over the world to come.
Correct. So they had to let Israelis in. Clearly, they're not going to make it easy for Israelis, I guess. They're not going to let Israelis do it the way they want to and identify as Israelis. So I know we had this story in the Post, and it'll be interesting to see if it changes, because I can't imagine. I mean, first of all, there's just pro-Israel organizations, like especially like legal organizations that have come to specialize. Unfortunately, the name escapes me at the moment, but there's specifically an organization in the UK that has really specialized in dealing with sports discrimination and has won some case. It's not trial, you know, it didn't go to trial, but they've like, you know, sent lawyerly letters and convinced people to change things to not discriminate against Israel. So my guess is going to be that this isn't going to last very long.
You know, I mean, you know, it's incredible though, when I think about these things, and it's not, sadly, it's not the only instance, and these things occasionally do happen. There still are some countries around the world which have yet to establish formal diplomatic relations with the state of Israel. But like, for God's sake, Israel is coming up on its 75th Independence Day, or 75 years that this country has existed. Now, not everyone wanted us here. Not everyone has, you know, there were some countries that tried to destroy us, right? The, you know, we're next October, not this October, but I was thinking about this the other day, how October 2023, that's going to be 50 years to the Yom Kippur War. I mean, you know, but that's exactly the point. Like, it's been 50 years since they've really tried to wipe us off the map. And there's the Abraham Accords, there's peace
treaties. And half of those countries have peace with us.
Exactly. Now, I mean, we have peace with Egypt and Jordan. We're supplying gas now to Egypt and Jordan.
Qatar. Supplying gas to Lebanon too, indirectly.
Grow up. I think these people just need to grow up, right?
And definitely. You sometimes read like media from the Arab world or just from like the radical left, and when they write Israel, they'll write it in quotation marks. And I'm like, how old are you? You know, like, it's ridiculous. Okay. And I'm going to write now Kuwait in quotation marks because they don't like me. Like, it's just like incredibly immature. It's just like but you know what? This is like all right. So they're acting like losers. They're acting like crybabies.
No, they're acting like losers. But I also think it's important. And maybe this ties into the Gaza operation of last week, but it's the fact that people around the world need to understand, and I think I know you get that, I know that I get it, right? But we understand that unfortunately there still are forces out there that have yet to come to terms with the fact that Israel exists here, right? And there still are these radical actors like the Islamic Jihad that fired over 1,000 rockets into Israel in the span of 3 days that don't want Israel here. I mean, so Qatar is basically, by doing this, by refusing to allow for Israel to exist in the drop-down menu, is basically siding with these forces and with these terrorist organizations, and is basically saying, we don't want Israel.
That doesn't surprise me that Qatar is siding with them. I mean, aside from the fact that the stadiums for this World Cup were built by slave labor, so we're not talking about people who are living in the 21st century. But when it comes to Israel specifically, I mean, they are the main funders of Hamas, which our government facilitates, bizarrely. And they are also, you know, behind Al Jazeera, which is just a endless source of anti-Semitism around the world.
I'll tell you, I met the Sheikh Muhammad bin Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani. Right, Sheikh Muhammad is the brother of the Emir of Qatar. He would not remember meeting me, but he and I took a course together at the Harvard Kennedy School back in 2013. And he did not like Israel. He did not like Jews. And he actually was the guy who led Qatar's winning bid to host the FIFA World Cup this coming November. And we all know, by the way, that there have been a lot of allegations of corruption around how Qatar got its won to be able to host the World Cup, right? There's been a lot of reports about that and the fact that he was the one who was involved in it. No, I'll just leave that to everyone's speculation. But, yeah. but I never felt, just from, you know, taking that class with him, that he was, that these were people who had any affinity towards us, either as a religion, as a people, as a nation. So not at all surprising.
I don't know. People don't need to have an affinity towards us. It's like the act of promotion of hate that's a problem.
Well, that...
right? Yeah, like, right. I don't know.
Like, just
I don't
be pariv. Just right. Don't, like, don't have anything. Don't have any feelings.
Right. There are lots of countries all over the world that don't have any Jews in them, and most people have never met a Jew, and like, I'm sure that they don't really think about us that much.
Except that we might have horns. Yeah, some of them think so.
Right. Or they think that we control the banks, and some of them like the us for it, which is also one of the weird things.
And we have space lasers.
Right.
We do a lot of crazy things, but speaking of lasers, so we have yet to use our laser in the Gaza operation, but this past weekend, a lot of fighting broke out on Friday afternoon. Operation Breaking Dawn, Lahav, you were having a bit of fun with that in our internal Jerusalem Post WhatsApp group. Of the yes. name.
Did you get the reference though? Because I feel like I'm at the like upper age limit for
it.
That.
I got it. Okay. Yes.
So it's a for those of our listeners who don't know. No, but I'm even a little bit old for this. For the Twilight movies, it is the name of the Twilight movies.
I didn't watch the movies, but I mean, they were all over the place. They were the hottest thing a few years ago. Like, you couldn't miss it.
Right. It's also the name of the weirdest of all the Twilight movies. I was not interested in Twilight. Like I said, I was a little bit too old for it already. I was like in college, not high school. And then when I heard what this one was about, I actually had to read it out of morbid curiosity, which is that the main character has a baby and the baby is a vampire. So it is a really weird book.
So what, you know, interesting choice of a name. Not sure if they had that in mind. I think we found over the years that the Israel Defense Forces doesn't really give too much thought to the way the name translates into English.
Not at all. And you know, it was easier to, like, they could have said Break of Dawn and it would have been better. Just the tiniest little thing.
Right. Well, but they didn't. And you know, putting that aside for a moment, the operation, I think, you know, when I'm looking at it, 3 days, it was about just, I think under, it was like 55 hours. And it seemed successful, right? Israel took the initiative. It came in after 3 days that it basically had to limit and restrict any movement along the border with Gaza from the residents who live there. And we'll actually hear in an interview later in the podcast with Adele Raymer, who is a resident. She calls it the Western Negev of Kibbutz Nirim, but of the so-called Gaza envelope and those towns that are near there, they weren't able to move for 3 days. So the government and the IDF took the initiative, took out this Islamic Jihad terrorist, by the way, in a really cool bombing, which we could talk about. And that set off 3 days of fighting, over 1,000 rockets. But Israel pretty much, I mean, the way I look at it, very accurate, very precise, very surgical, not a lot of collateral damage at all, achieved its goals, degrading Islamic Jihad, no real diplomatic fallout. You know, pretty much is the best you could ask for, I think, from Israel's perspective.
Yeah, I think it went really well. Your friend Peter Lerner, who used to be the international spokesperson of the IDF, made an interesting point on Twitter, which I also quoted in one of my articles about this. Like, one of the reasons it went so well is that you have Israel, the heavyweight, fighting Islamic Jihad, the featherweight, you know. Fighting Hamas is harder. They have more resources and better control over Gaza.
I mean, by the way, you know, the featherweight, they still fire 1,000 rockets into Israel, right? Now, yes, Iron Dome had a 96% interception rate of rockets that needed to be intercepted. That's a hell of a lot of rockets, right, to be able to fire.
Yeah, I think the government still gets credit, the government, the army, everyone gets credit for managing this well, and letting, and also stopping it before it got out of control. I think actually it's to some extent legitimizes Hamas, and that's a little bit dangerous. I don't know that there was a choice in this case, but you know, it's not like we just it's not like last year's operation, which in theory set Hamas back.
Which I think you're right. What made this interesting on what you're saying is that Hamas, right, was not involved, and Israel made a clear point and was very surgical in the way it operated, was to not hit Hamas, right, because it wanted to keep Hamas on the sidelines. And what we've heard in the last few days, definitely from people on the left, but I would say even people in the center, is to an extent, you know, look, Hamas, they were pretty good. Maybe, you know, we should talk to them. We should negotiate with them. Now, I'm all in favor of trying to find some sort of long-term arrangement with Hamas that would prevent violence, right? But let's not fool ourselves. This is a terrorist organization bent on our destruction, right? These are people who are, as we speak, actively digging tunnels across the border. They're amassing arms and weapons. They're indoctrinating their youth to hate us. They're not good people suddenly just because they sat out this one, right?
Right, and, absolutely.
Right. And I think the government, by the way, I mean, one of the reasons that Hamas probably sat on the sidelines here was, you know, because this path, the government over the last year has allowed 14,000 Palestinians from Gaza to come into Israel and to work. And there's talk of more economic aid that could go their way, and more infrastructure renovations and things like that. So Hamas understands that that's good for it and it wants to maintain control. But let's not fool ourselves, right? I mean, we do have to be careful.
My feeling about the sort of economic solution, whatever you want to call it, is that, you know, on the one hand, the humanitarian situation in Gaza is terrible. It is maybe not as terrible as certain people like to make it out to be. It is not the most densely the cities of B'nai Brak and Givatayim are more densely populated than Gaza. But, you know, but it's still a bad situation, people living in poverty, etc. And so I don't want to doom them to that. But at the same time, my feeling is like it's sort of like Hezbollah, where like just because they're not attacking us doesn't mean that they're not biding their time and preparing and amassing more and more weapons for the day that they decide it's convenient.
For sure. This wasn't the good time for them. So they set this one out. I mean, just a year ago, we had Operation Guardian of the Walls, right? Where they fired thousands and thousands of rockets at Israel.
So they usually take more than a year to like lick their wounds and start really seriously attacking us again.
We should all kind of just still be clear on that. But one thing that you highlighted in a very interesting article, I think, was the way the public diplomacy was run this time. And I think if we compare it, this operation, Breaking Dawn to Guardian of Walls, sounds like the Dungeons and Dragons names. Anyhow, yeah. They did a better job, it felt like, no?
Yeah, I agree. I think they were really well coordinated this time with good messaging.
And there was that one instance that you highlighted. I want to, you know, talk a little bit about that, because that was really spectacular.
Right. So on Saturday night at around 9 p.m. Israel time, there was an explosion in Jabalia, which is in northern Gaza, and 4 children were killed in the explosion. And of course, immediately there were pictures of the corpses and people were blaming Israel.
Right.
There was a tweet from Knesset member Ahmed Tibi from the Joint List, for example, just really blaming Israel and like tagging like the White House on like number 10 Downing Street. Like, this is the right to defend itself that you support killing children, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, the IDF very quickly came out and said, we didn't do anything in Jabalia like for 2.5 hours before that. And the different arms in charge of public diplomacy and messaging, there was the public diplomacy directorate, which is part of the prime minister's office, of the foreign ministry, the IDF, also the Shin Bet was involved, even though they don't really put out so many public statements. They all discussed this. They very quickly realized it had potential to be extremely damaging to Israel, you know, 4 children killed.
Right.
And they within the hour put out a statement explaining we had nothing to do with this. What was lucky was that at about the same time, videos started going up online from some Arabic media, I don't know if it was Palestinian or otherwise, that actually showed an Islamic Jihad rocket, like Islamic Jihad launching like a salvo of like a bunch of rockets, and one of them falling down in Gaza. Mm-hmm. Right. And so there was very clear that that was what happened. And immediately with those statements, the media, the international media, almost everyone wrote that Israel said it wasn't them, that it was actually an Islamic Jihad rocket that fell. The one thing that I would criticize maybe is that Israel and the IDF didn't release their official approved video until the next morning, even though I realize that there are sort of constraints that the actual government has as opposed to like some random person on Twitter.
I think they were fast. They were quicker. They didn't do the typical thing that we've learned over the years, which is, you know, we're sorry for the loss of life and we're looking into it. And then that just basically makes it seem like you're guilty, even if you're not. And yeah, they right exactly. away pushed back. And that's what helped keep the narrative the way it ended up being, which was this was not Israel. And that kept the diplomatic fallout from happening. And it also, imagine for a moment that there would have been significant civilian casualties. That could also, by the way, have pushed Hamas into the conflict as well. And then this would have been a whole other scale. So it was well done by Israel. The video, that's where I think they still could improve, right? Is to try to get, they need to get these visuals out faster. But I think they've recognized and learned that they need to work at a faster pace than they have in the past. And that's encouraging.
And I think the coordination was impressive. I mean, I think that in the past, like the IDF spokesperson was not working so well with the prime minister's office, for example.
Is this a Lapid thing, right? Yair Lapid now being in the prime minister's office for what, about 2 months? You think it has to do with him?
The only direct involvement I know of Lapid's was very minor, in that there was a security cabinet meeting going on and they chose a minister to go out and speak to the Hebrew media. Mm-hmm. But I think he deserves credit for making a very good appointment. He appointed Lior Chayat, who was until recently the spokesman of the foreign ministry, to be the head of the public diplomacy directorate. And he was an excellent spokesman for the foreign ministry, and he's clearly doing a good job here. I think that Israel did get its message out very well. It's hard for me to judge the previous guy, Elad Tene, because that job isn't usually someone who has direct contact with journalists, and because there wasn't a war or anything, I didn't have anything to do with him. But I do know that this is a good appointment instead that Lapid made.
Mm-hmm. But I also feel like Lapid is maybe strategic about these issues, right? He gets the importance of communications and crisis communications.
Yeah, well, so one of the things which is not public communications, but that Lapid emphasized over the course of this operation, was to have constant contact with Israel's partners in the West for them to understand what Israel's doing, that Israel is trying to keep this a very narrow operation, very focused, that Israel's trying not to draw Hamas in, you know, that we don't know where it'll lead, but the goal is not to, you know, have some sort of huge military operation right now. And you could see that people sort of waited. It took a day or so for people to start releasing messages. And when they did, they were generally, Israel's a right to defend itself, rockets are bad, you know, and they didn't start immediately saying, you know, loss of civilian life and things like that. A little bit of it came later, but there was really no discernible diplomatic pressure on Israel coming from the parties whose diplomatic pressure Israel actually cares about.
Right. And as quickly as the operation began and ended, we went back to politics, right? And this week was two rounds of primaries, right?
You could see it. Just going back to the sort of return to routine, you could see it with Netanyahu, right? During the war, Netanyahu finally deigned to meet with a prime minister to get briefed on security.
Right. Wow.
He's supposed to do that every month. With Bennett didn't want to meet with Netanyahu either, and so he let Netanyahu meet with his military secretary every month. With Lapid, Lapid said the law says you have to meet with the prime minister. You either meet with me or you don't get a meeting. And so last month, Netanyahu didn't meet with anyone, but now it was wartime. Netanyahu asked for a briefing and Lapid met with him, and they both put out very good statements. And Netanyahu said that he, you know, positive about each other and how the meeting went. And Netanyahu said that he supports the army and the government in the war. 24 hours after, or like something like 22 hours after the ceasefire went into effect, Gantz and Lapid get up, they give their end of war sort of victory statement, which notably, Lapid really emphasized that, you know, the Gazans could have a better life and better economy, as we discussed earlier. Netanyahu releases his response, his like rebuttal, which, you know, who was asking for a rebuttal here, but okay, where he says, you know, good job, Tzahal, good job, you know, on how this operation went. But this operation would not have happened if we weren't going for an election, because then they would have been reliant on Ra'am's votes, and Ra'am would not have allowed an operation in Gaza. Mm-hmm. So it was like the ceasefire, like happened.
Dr. Bibi, Mr. Netanyahu, something like that.
Right. Something like that. And that was it. That was like the sign. Once Lapid and Gantz had their victory lap, it was like the
bell ringing. Okay. And then there was, you know, yeah, I'm not the guy usually coming to the defense of Netanyahu, but Ram Ben Barak, a former top Mossad guy who's a senior member of Yair Lapid's party, right, was the one who came out and said that during the operation, I think it was even, that Netanyahu is mentally ill, right? And then he went ahead and apologized for the comment. I mean, you know, look.
I'm not entirely sure Netanyahu was wrong about his point either, but it was just like so...
yeah, but the mudslinging,
symbolic.
Yeah, and the mudslinging is back in full throttle, and that just means that Israel's back to what it was, right? You
know, right. And by the way, that was also why, like, another article I wrote this week, that I don't think this is going to have a discernible effect in the polls. It went well for Lapid, and it might move some votes around within the anti-BB block, but I don't think any votes are going to move from BB to Lapid because of this.
No, people aren't going to vote for, you know, move from Likud to Yesh Atid, or very few would do that. People are very locked in their blocks.
Right, and that's the game, right? For Lapid to get more votes than Gantz, I mean, you know, they have their own little battle going on because they both think they deserve to be prime minister, but like overall, like it's an election between two blocks.
And it seems that one block has more of a chance, which is the BB block, than the other side, because as long as they can't get the Haredim over to their side, they're not going to be able to form a coalition. So the most that Lapid, it seems, will be able to kind of hope for is just to prevent BB from getting a coalition, and then they'll be able to keep, he'll be able to stay on as prime minister.
Pretty much, yeah.
To an extent. It's difficult to see how he has another way forward.
Yeah. So last week we interviewed candidates in the Labor and Likud primaries. This week we can already talk about the results in Labor. They said out with the old, in with the new. Anyone who's over 50, I don't know, how old is Mayron Michaeli? I think she's under 50. Anyone who's over 50 was out. And they basically, other than Mayron Michaeli herself, I think everyone is a first term Knesset member who was reelected. Oh, Mayron Michaeli is 55. All right. Well, in any case,
she's a young 55.
A young 55. Yes. Yeah. Everyone else is a first term Knesset member. Everyone else in a realistic spot. That is the number one person after Michaeli is pretty radical, I would say. I mean, she was used to be a top aide to Shelly Yachimovich, former labor leader Shelly Yachimovich.
I had to Google who she was, honestly.
Yeah.
Lazimi.
Yeah, but I don't know. She managed to, I guess, stand out within the party and do a good campaign among party members. I don't think she was someone who really stood out in particular to the general public, but she holds very far left views. And I would say, I mean, you were saying when we were discussing right before this that it's becoming increasingly difficult to distinguish between labor and merits at this point.
And labor used to be different. That was the thing, right? Labor was a place of these generals, of Robin-esque type of characters. Omer Bar-Lev is an example who, you know, whether he's good or bad doesn't make a difference, but he was, you know, this IDF guy who is now pushed to the slot 16, 17 or something like that. I'm sorry, 9. And then Nachman Shai, who was pushed over to also like the mid-teens. They're getting rid of the older generation. The younger generation are very much people who could also sit in merits, right? And then the question becomes, so why vote for Labor? And I think that that's what Mayron Michaeli's challenge will be. So they'll be able to take votes from merits. I don't know that they'll be able to take votes away from Benny Gantz or Yair Lapid.
Right.
Which is, that Labor used to be a different kind of party.
Entirely. I mean, Labor used to be what, Lapid or Blue and White is. And honestly, like, they're both parties that are teetering near the threshold, merits more so than labor. And if that's going to hurt the block, right? If any party goes under the threshold, then they're definitely not going to be able to keep BB out of power, which is their number one goal.
Right.
I mean, and BB's challenge is also that, you know, there's the Zionist Spirit Party, basically what used to be known as Yamina. And they, last week, when they first sort of announced the new name and that they were bringing Yoaz Hendel into the party, they passed the threshold in most but not all polls. And then this week, they don't pass it in any polls. And that's like, you know, Netanyahu will have to either find a way to really, really get a lot more votes somehow from the other side or from the center for Likud or for Zionist Spirit to pass the threshold.
And you know what the best part of all of this, Lahav, is that it's middle of August, so we still have 2.5 months to talk about this every week. Because it's going to keep going.
Listen, we got sick of talking about Iran every week, which once again, this week, you know, the West says it's final.
Don't talk about it.
So now we have something else to talk about every week.
For a bit. So we have a great, really, I found it to be a very moving interview with Adele Raymer, who, Lahav, you brought to my attention. She is a very well-known kind of spokesperson and face of the residents of the Western Negev, the Gaza border communities, originally from the Bronx, has been living in Nirim for a long time, since the mid-70s, and really told us kind of what it was like as just a person. Forget about the security, the army, what it was like as a resident to live there as a mother and a grandmother with children and grandchildren nearby, what that was like. So I think you all will appreciate, and it's worth a listen. We're privileged to be joined by Adele Raymer, who is the head of a group on Facebook called Life on the Border with Gaza, things people may not know but should, and has been living in Kibbutz Nirim just along the border with the Gaza Strip since 1975. So not a short amount of time. Originally from the Bronx. Adele, thanks for joining us. We're speaking just after the most recent IDF operation in the Gaza Strip, Breaking Dawn, as the army called it. And while it ended after just 3 days and the army and Israel declaring success, we're curious what it was like for you, a longtime resident of what's known as Otef Aza, the Gaza border communities, what it was like from your perspective living there during these 3 days of complete rocket onslaught from Islamic Jihad towards Israel.
Okay, so first of all, thank you for hosting me. I prefer to call this area the Western Negev because I prefer to identify with us geographically as Israel, as opposed to geographically regarding Gaza. That's just a personal preference of mine. Unfortunately, no, most people do not know where the Western Negev is when I mention it. So I'm happy to bring it up here. And
Negev is just after the Gaza border.
Right.
That'll be funny. Yes. And it was more than 3 days. We had before that 3 days of what we were calling a silent escalation. Mm-hmm. And there were 3 days when we were limited in our movements around the area. Roads were closed. The part of the perimeter road in my community, in fact, was even closed, where I walk in the mornings when I go on my morning walks for exercise. It was closed off because it had a vision line into and from Gaza. So the army was concerned of a real and present threat put out by the Islamic Jihad of sniper fire or anti-tank fire on civilian vehicles. Our fields are between us and the border. My kibbutz, the part of the kibbutz that we live on is about 2 kilometers from the border. And in those 2 kilometers, we also have our fields where our farmers work. In fact, my son-in-law works in those fields every day. So the farmers couldn't go out to work, and we were limited in where we could travel. There were areas, intercity, interurban roads that go along the 232 road along the border with the Gaza Strip that were closed off completely. So if it took a person 8 minutes usually to get to work, they could have been on the road for half an hour and a half because they had to circumvent an entire area. So that was the 3 days before that the rest of the country didn't really feel so much, but we certainly did. Not to mention the tension that was palpable, that we felt. We, you know, like they say that the birds and the cats can smell it when an earthquake is coming, and those of us who live here can sense it when an escalation is coming. So my daughter already packed her bags when these silent escalation began, because she has three littles and she did not want to be here. She wanted to be able to make a quick getaway once the shooting started. And indeed, when it started on Friday at about 4:15, like within 15 minutes, she threw her kids in the car and was out of here. She drove out of rocket range with them. And I usually stay behind during times like these because it's times like these that I blog and vlog and give interviews and tell the world what it's like here, because what goes on the other side is horrible, but it ain't no picnic here either. So we had 3 days in which my safe room became my bedroom and the place to which I would run every time there was an incoming rocket alert, because where I live, we have from 0 to 10 seconds between the time that we hear the incoming rocket alert until we hear the explosion. And I wouldn't say that I'm used to it, because nobody gets used to a situation like this. Nobody gets used to living under fire. But we like to call this place 95% heaven, 5% hell. So during that 5%, it's not that we're used to it, but we know how to handle ourselves. Even the youngest of children know what it means when they hear that red alert, code red, Tzeva Adom warning over the loudspeaker. So that was our lives here for about 3 days. The children, 99% of the children were not in the community. Families evacuated either Friday, like my daughter did, Friday evening, or if not Saturday morning. So those who were left behind are either people who are staying behind because they have a role to play here, and you can't just evacuate a community. There are cows to feed. There's all sorts of jobs that have to be done in the community that you can't just everybody leave, lock the key, and you know, turn out the lights. So most of the children were not here. I did stay here, and I had my one eye on the news all the time. I TikToked my little heart out. I did Facebook Lives when there were attacks and I was sitting in my safe room. I'd do a Facebook Live and explain to people what was going on. And that's what it was like here for 3 days. Yesterday morning, it already I had the sense that it was finishing, although we had not a few attacks until it was over. But everybody who lives here knows that when they start talking ceasefire, the other side lets rip everything they've got. So that's the most dangerous time to be here, the most dangerous time to be outside. But we're patient, and I put my full faith in the IDF, the most moral army in the world. And I was so proud to see how everything was handled, how those 3 days of quiet escalation, silent escalation, where lots of people on these military WhatsApp groups that I'm part of because of other things that I do, were complaining, how can the Army let this happen? How can we remain hostage? And I was sitting back and saying to myself, I have a feeling there's a plan. And I put my total trust in the IDF. And indeed, there was it was planned very well, and they built it on intel and worked on that intel. And everything that they did was for a purpose. It was due to real and present threats, an attack that was about to be carried out and thwarted by the IDF alertness and preparation.
So this, what you're saying, this was so different in a lot of ways. I mean, not only was this lockdown in advance, not something that I don't know if it had never happened before, but certainly not recently, but it also, they wrapped it up very quickly. They had very specific targets. Do you think that this is a better way to do things than some Absolutely. Of the longer operations we've had in recent years?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in general, since this government came in, one of the other things that I do that I hinted to before, we have since 2018 until last summer, we suffered from incendiary balloon arson. And I built a map, in fact, two maps, mapping out the arson fires. So I keep track of this very carefully. Now, this year, there were very, very few, but I can say that every time there was even one balloon, there was an immediate response. And that has to do with the people who were in the government at this time during this past year. So I think it's all connected. The IDF give their recommendations, but it's the government that decides it. And this time, from what I can see, the government went hand in hand with the IDF recommendations.
Adele, on the other hand, though, I mean, I don't live there, right? So easy for me to look from where I live in Jerusalem and judge what's happening in the Western Negev. But I am curious, you know, when you look at the last, I would say from the pullout of Gaza in 2005, right? So the last 17 years, you've had an operation pretty much on the average of every 2 years, some big, large scale operations, some bigger than others. There was Castellet in 2008-09. There was Protective Edge, Tsuke Tan, right back in 2014, which lasted for 50 days. Then you had smaller ones, shorter ones, 3 days, 2 days, whatever. But every 2 years or so, on average, you have this explosion. And as someone who lives there, I mean, does there come a point, and I hear your support for the IDF and your support for the government, but does there come a point that you say this is crazy already? Like, this just isn't normal? There's got to be a better solution than just every year or two another conflict?
Absolutely. But in the past few months, there has also been a change, and thousands of Gazans received work permits to come in.
14,000 now have work permits to enter Israel, right?
And this is something, you know, a hungry neighbor is a dangerous neighbor, and this is something that people need a horizon of hope. And this is something that gave Gazans a horizon of hope. Also, the humanitarian supplies that are let in and the petrol that's let in. And I know that Egypt was helping them a lot with rebuilding Gaza. A reconstructed Gaza is in our best interest. So, and I saw the government this past year doing things that enable that to happen more than it has in a long time. So yes, things are nuts the way they are, and they have to change. I think we started to find a way to change them, and I hope that's not going to, I hope that's going to continue. Because even this time, the objection of the amount of
tailwind
support that that the Islamic Jihad got from Gazans was not as much as we've heard in the past. I think this was a very different round. I think this was able to be shorter and more effective due to the fact that they have a lot to lose by going to war with us. And the people know that.
Well, they knew that in the first place, though, right? I mean, I know that you're... You're, what you do is to talk about sort of the what it's like living on the border. So I don't necessarily expect you to be the military expert, but it has to be even more frustrating for someone like you than it is for the rest of us that this is sort of this endless cycle of one fight after another every couple of years. So what do you think the answer is to change things?
What is the answer that change things or will change things? Or
what is a way? What is, do you think there's a way to break out of this cycle?
For sure. Hey, I lived here when I came to live here, we used to get in a car and drive into Gaza. We'd go to the beach. We'd go to the Shuk. I have seen it be different here, which is why I can also imagine it being different in the future. And thanks to the Abraham Accords, I'm hoping that this is going to help change things because it shows that we know how to make peace, we Israelis. We made peace with Jordan. We made peace with Egypt. We made peace with Bahrain, for goodness sakes, and with the UAE. And we can make peace. We have to work towards it. We have to find the way to do it. And I'm hoping that the Abraham Accords, the countries that have already come on board with the Abraham Accords and countries that hopefully will join in also, will help push our sides together, the Palestinians and the Israelis. The problem is, one of the problems is, but you can't give me something that you don't have. And as long as the Palestinians are so divided within themselves, it's very challenging being to come to the table. Because they're fighting within themselves. They're like tribal warfare is going on without us. Like they don't need us to fight. They do it really well by themselves. So they need help making peace within themselves, deciding who's their leader, deciding who is going to come to the table and who can make agreements with Israel. And then that will make our job a lot easier. We cannot solve the problems of Gaza. We cannot solve the problems of the infighting and the politics that goes on there. Their leaders care more about their own pockets and their own political power than they do about their people. Israel helps the Gazans more than the Hamas and the Islamic Jihad.
This was one of the amazing things of like the rockets, right? Is that one in every five rockets that was fired by Islamic Jihad landed inside Gaza. So
their own children.
Right, so in killing their own children, but in that last salvo that you spoke about, which always comes at the end towards it near, as we near a ceasefire, they fired hundreds of rockets, right? And they knew that one out of every five was landing inside Gaza and killing their own people, and they still did it. Right. So
that's nuts.
Right.
It's nuts.
But so you mentioned how, you know, what Gaza used to look like back when you moved there. So you've been there since 1975. That's a long time to be living anywhere, definitely in a place where every few years, at least over the last 17 years, there's been a conflict. Has there ever been a point, Adele, that you've contemplated leaving, moving to Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, somewhere else a little further, maybe the Eastern Negev instead of the Western Negev?
Why would I do that? This country is so small and we're in such a rough neighborhood. So I could go to Ashkelon, but they get rockets. I could go to Beersheba, they get rockets. Ashdod gets rockets. Tel Aviv has had buses blowing up. There were periods when my children were growing up that I forbade them from going to Tel Aviv because it was so scary with all the buses blowing up. And in Jerusalem, there were knifings and buses blowing up. And up north, you get rockets. Where do we go? Where do we go? Leave Israel?
Bronx. You go back Bronx. To the Bronx.
Oh, yeah. Bronx is real safe. Yeah. So I'm a Zionist. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I made Aliyah because I believe that Israel is the one place, our ancient ancestral homeland, where Jews can feel safe from anti-Semitism, from Jew hatred. So there's no reason why I would go any place. This is my home. Nirim is my home. And it's more than just a home. It's more than mortar and bricks. It's a community. And in fact, I have to leave very soon because our community evacuated with the children and everything. And they're coming back now. They're starting to come back. And I'm on the committee of people who are going to our Moadon, to our members club, to open it up at 5:30 and welcome the people that have come back. So this is why would I leave a home like this, a community like this, that I've gone through so much with this community. I was married here. I was divorced here. I was married again. I buried my parents. I buried my husband. And this community has supported me and loved me all along. And I have loved them back. So how is that something that I would ever want to leave?
I mean, it's also the community has also suffered losses, right? There was Zevik Etzion, Shachar Melamed in 2014. Who were killed in a rocket attack.
That's right. And Gadi Yarkoni, right, who lost both of his legs in that very same attack, and he's now our mayor. So this is a community that knows what tragedy is and knows what support is and knows what resilience is. And in fact, if the camera were open, I would show you a tattoo that I have on my arm that says resilience, because that's what I have and that's what keeps me going.
So not about the war, but since you've had such a long attachment to this kibbutz, what made you come there in the first place?
It was part of my army service. Ah. I made Aliyah in 1973. I was in Young Judea, and I was on Young Judea year course 72-73. I went back to the States August 73 in October 73, of course, the Yom Kippur War broke out. And I said, well, what am I doing in America? Israel needs me. And I made Aliyah in December 73 to Kibbutz Keturah, which was founded in October 73 by Young Judea. And I was drafted into the army, and I was on kibbutz in the Nahal, and that was part of my army service. And for personal reasons, I decided that was not the place that I wanted to live. And in order to move, I had to get permission from the army to go to another kibbutz where I could finish my service. And that's how I got to Nirim. And I've been here ever since. So I guess I'm still sort of finishing out my service.
it's a long service. But long Adele, service. It's also... it's also inspirational to hear you talk about resilience and Zionism and how you don't leave a home and what Nirim actually stands for. And I think that, you know, people around the world forget about the fact that they don't appreciate what people like you in the Western Negev / Gaza border go through, but they also, I think, don't appreciate what motivates people to stay in places like that and to keep going and not to give up. And that's.
And to stay in Israel, Yaakov, and to stay in Israel. Israel's not an easy place to live. It's one of the most expensive places in the world to live. And yet you're here. Lahav is here. We're here.
Right. Adele, thanks so much for joining us on the Jerusalem Post podcast. It was great to have you. We hope you stay safe and really what you do and just watching you on Facebook and your videos and that you post is really inspirational and I think does a great service for Israel and for the larger Jewish community. So toda rabah for that.
Thank you so much. And I'd love it if people join my group, Life on the Border. And I'd love it if they followed me on TikTok. I need 2 more followers on TikTok to be able to do TikTok live. 2 more followers.
All right. Follow Adele so she can do TikTok live.
Can I just say one thing about TikTok for a moment? I mean, we don't know exactly how old you are, but you kind of gave it away when you said that you came here in 1972, 73. Right. You're not the TikTok age, right? You know, like the TikTok age are kids in like their teens, maybe in their 20s.
That's right. And that's who we're trying to influence and make an impression on. Mm-hmm. So during the fighting yesterday and the day before, I did Instagram lives with the head of social media from the foreign ministry. And we wanted to do a TikTok live, but I was short like 20 people. You can't do TikTok live unless you have 1,000 followers.
Okay. So listeners, you guys, you all have a mission. Follow Adele on TikTok. That's it.
Zioness on the border, Z-I-O-N-E-S-S on the border. TikTok on Instagram and Life on the Border on Facebook for our group. Thank you so much for hosting me.
Thank you, Adele. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. If you enjoyed it, please forward it to your friends and family and give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, where this podcast can be found, along with on Google Play and Spotify and all the other major podcast platforms. And we will be back next week to discuss more of the news from Israel.